I found a gray hair on my chin this week.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's been a rough one. And then day before yesterday, I thought that I got a lot of messages. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was related to this because, I mean, groundbreaking news. No, turns out that their bird flu has caught on with the elephant seals, the southern elephant seals, and 1,300 young puppies have died.
So this week you found out, one, you are getting older.
Yes.
And two, your favorite animal is in severe threat of extinction.
No.
No, just dying.
Just a new breed is just not doing fine. Well. But I mean, enough horny male elephant seal. So it will be fine next year, but don't die.
Sure. For hip. For hip. What a joy.
Hey.
We're back so soon.
Hey.
Incredible.
How are you
doing? Who would have thought?
How are you doing?
You look a bit old today.
Fuck off.
This time we'll be delving into weird book adaptations.
Yes.
Which is, of course, inspired by this week's release of Data's ultimate favorite. No, that's not true. Data's very beloved Martin Scorsese.
It's pronounced Scorsese.
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 Okay.
He says Scorsese. It's also new information to me, but that's where I'm going. I've heard him say it himself this week. Scorsese. It's pronounced Scorsese.
Martin Scorsese.
Scorsese.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So there's a new movie, and it's Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes.
And that's a book adaptation?
Yes.
Okay. Exciting
of
stuff.
Of a non-fiction book, so that's the weird thing. But yeah. So
I haven't seen it yet, but have you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great.
This week. Yeah, no, we'll get a full review at the end of the show. So just stay tuned for that. But yeah, great stuff.
Anyway, there's loads of adaptations to talk about.
Yeah.
What marks a weird or difficult or interesting, fascinating adaptation for you?
You have some whole section of books that seem inadaptable, and they are fun when they are adapted and then they fail. You also sometimes just see things like the Angry Birds movie. You think to yourself, like,
that wasn't a book, I hope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you brought a phenomenal film to the table that I haven't seen, but I heard of, and it's adaptation, I can tell.
Yes.
So we're going to delve into, I think, that movie only is a good discussion on what makes a weird adaptation.
It is really weird.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, one of the things that's interesting, there's also this whole section of books. I've got one here on my shelf. Blood Meridian, for instance, that is everybody wants to adapt it and nobody succeeds, so it's still not done. The last I heard was Mel Gibson.
Do they write it but just never get to production? Or
I don't know if you I don't know how much you know about Blood Meridian, but I mean
nothing.
Cormac McCarthy is the writer of No Country for Old Men and The Road, and his books are incredibly sparse, no interpunction really, except for dots and commas sometimes. It's incredible, and no names. It's
minimalist.
Just a kid, incredibly. And this book is incredibly violent in a very nasty way. So I heard somebody said, well, you can just do it. I mean, people love violence. They go to a... Yeah, but it's not the same. This is scalping on a scale that... Yeah. So, okay. I mean, you've got books like that just don't work. And then sometimes you have directors like David Cronenberg who seem to always just make a point out of adapting books that everybody deems inadaptable.
Yeah.
And that's very funny.
But from this introduction, it's already really clear that there are some things that seem to get lost when they're on screen that aren't lost in writing. Do you have any ideas about what that could be?
What's lost on screen that is in writing?
Like, why couldn't you do the Blood Meridian?
It hasn't really to do with the style of the book. It's more to do with the substance in this case of Blood Meridian. I haven't finished Blood Meridian. Mm-hmm. For the simple fact that after 90 pages of hard work, I it was just I wanted something a bit more cheerful. Yeah, no, it's it's one of the great American novels, but everybody says so. But hey, and I mean, another book that's on my shelf, and which is your favorite book, I believe, is also one of those books long time considered to be pretty unadaptable, and that's Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita.
I'm not sure if it's my favorite book, but okay, I thought so. No, well, we had a conversation about it recently. That's true, and I think it's an excellent book. So it's definitely up there for me. So that kind of brings me to what I think is an important part of why it's so hard sometimes to adapt a book into a film, and that is that it's hard to do. To do justice to someone's thought process. Mm. Because when you're reading, you can just read along with the thoughts and it doesn't sound like annoying or fake. But if you do a whole movie in voiceover, and this is something that adaptation also discusses, it seems lazy somehow in film in a way that it isn't lazy in book form, because everything is text in book. I think that is a problem with Lolita as well. Although I think the films are fine. Not my favorite films ever. I think the book is a better story than the films are. Not successful as an adaptation, but successful as films nonetheless.
You know what happens when you get the inverse of a voiceover like you have in the book? Like when the book is mimicking the talking of the film, doing everything in expert. You know what you get then?
No.
The Da Vinci Code. It's terrible.
Oh, that's
Hello,
interesting.
Hello, I am bloody bloody blah, and I came from Scotland, and I say this things because I have to expose myself. Oh, I have to.
Did they start filming before they wrote the book?
No. Dan Brown just never heard of the interior monologue.
He just doesn't. He doesn't know.
And when you watch it's exactly the same. So it's very weird.
Right. Yeah. Kind of reminds me of those films where people are just in the first conversations they have in the film, they say the other person's character's name 20 times. And be like, hi, Data. It's lovely to see you, Data. Yeah. It's very important the audience remembers your name, Data. That's pathetic.
Yeah, adaptations can be tricky. And I also got some books that I have read that I just don't want to see adapted. Mm. Although there are adaptations of them. So one of them, which is Slaughterhouse-Five, for instance. I know that there is a film. I heard that it's perfectly fine. No intention of seeing it.
I haven't seen it either.
No.
I love the book, so.
Yeah. And
that's enough for me sometimes.
That book is so specific in its form as well and in its style that I'm just like, you know, the film is going to have to put water to the wine. And one of those writers that's always in the conversation similar to that book is Thomas Pynchon. Mm-hmm. I've got Inherent Vice on the shelf. I said so already in the script that, yes, it's one of my favorite unadaptable books. And we're not going to discuss it today because we'll get to... I've mentioned it already 5,000 times on this podcast.
But the reason we're not getting into it is because we both think it's a great idea to do a full Paul Thomas Anderson episode, which is just a really genius director. And there's a lot to talk about when it comes to him. So let's save that. I agree.
Yes. Yes.
I liked Inherent Vice, though, the movie, too.
Yeah.
But anything Joaquin, right?
Okay. Well, so these days we also see a lot of non-fiction adaptations, like Killers of the Flower Moon and Oppenheimer and Nomadland. All Oscar-worthy things. Big productions. Mm-hmm. Huge swaths of money and investments. And that's all based on non-fiction. I found one earlier today that I already forgotten to write down from the looks of it. Oh, yeah, no, I got one as well. It's a tradition that's been going on for a while now. But, we see it a little bit more these days. It's interesting. It's interesting to work from nonfiction as well. Do you have a favorite unadaptable book adaptation? Because that's like, I think, the big thing in cinema, at least, unadaptable books, unfilmable books. And
Yeah, well, you mentioned some before already, so I really like all the Cronenberg work. I think Naked Lunch and Crash and stuff.
Have you read Crash?
No, I have not read Crash, but I would.
You know what the writer of Crash said about the film?
No.
That the film is better than his own book.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Excellent work. And I'm not surprised, because the film is fantastic. But then, you know...
See a previous podcast about Crash, by the way, if you want to hear very differing opinions, then that film is good.
It wasn't Monica's thing.
It wasn't my guest thing. That conversation just fell flat on his ass. It was amazing.
I feel like some disagreement works in your favor sometimes.
Here a discussion just fell flat because if you don't get Crash, I mean, you're left with...
Yeah, there's not a lot.
Yeah.
It's like just people getting off on car crashes.
Yeah,
that just sounds really deranged
sex.
If you take it really seriously. Anyway, I keep losing my train of thought too because there's just so much. But from one David to the next, I really like Dune, but not the new ones. I like the 1984 Dune.
Have you seen that one?
You haven't?
No.
This is this is great because you can talk about the new one then. But it's widely considered, I think, one of David Lynch's worst films, and for good reason. It's extremely messy, and I once read this essay by David Foster Wallace, who wrote another completely unadaptable book, Infinite Jest. I don't think they tried yet, but I'm curious to see if anyone will. Anyway, he wrote an essay about Lynch and Dune in particular, and he said... Well, for one, he made a really funny comment about Kyle MacLachlan saying that he was potato-faced and maybe not like the best choice for someone who was supposed to be really regal. But David Lynch and Kyle do love each other, it seems.
Yes.
Anyway, I think the movie was just completely derailed by the studios. So I think what happened was that David Lynch had an idea for how to film this unadaptable book, really. And I think, like Cronenberg, he's weird enough that he could probably pull it off with like the really difficult storytelling, the chronology and all that stuff.
You mean Cronenberg doing June?
No,
I thought you were flirting with wild ideas.
No, I was saying that I think the way David Cronenberg can handle these really difficult narratives, like William S. Burroughs or whatever, I think David Lynch could do the same, and I think he could have done it for Dune had it not been for the studios who wanted him to make like a straight story out of it. That's a double joke because David Lynch made...
Anyway. That's good. It's not the proper use of the new bell that we got, but I like it nonetheless.
The bell is to shut up that.
Yes.
If it won't stop rambling. Anyway, now it's me who's rambling. But I wanted to say, Dune, it's really weird, the 1984 version. I think it looks great. I mean, it's from 1984 and it just has that 1980s aesthetic that I am a sucker for. I'll watch anything when it looks like that. But I also still think it's pretty good and it's fun and it has Sting as like the bad guy.
I was going to bring up Sting because the only thing I pretty much know about 1984 is doing is Sting with the weird underwear and that seems like a thing that Lynch's fault. That's Lynch's fault.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Anyway.
No, it doesn't look coherent at all.
It isn't, and I don't think you would like it, but I stand by it. I think it's cool.
I mean, then take the haptic, tactile approach that one of cinema's modern gods, pretty much, Denis Villeneuve, did by really just looking at the book like Dune and be like, you know how you should do it? If you combine Star Wars with Lawrence of Arabia. That's what he did.
Ba-ba-da-ba.
That's how it works. And more cool effects.
Well,
half practical effects, sand screens in proper desert, so the light and it... Well, to me, I think June was one of my films of the year. I think the fourth or fifth or something like that. I really loved June. I can't wait for the second part. And I'm going to watch that one in IMAX in Rotterdam.
That's a
with
Gonneke.
Yeah.
Hey.
Big shout. Okay, I should stop with the bell. I like the bell. It's a good new jingle. A bell.
It's addictive, apparently.
Yes.
I get it. I also think it's good. For me, it's a bit too clean. I just kind of get bored. I like that I like that it's messy in the other one, but that's just my personal preference. I don't think it's bad. Personally, I just can't stand Timothée Chalamet at this point. I used to like him. Chalamet. I think Call Me By Your Name, another book adaptation, is a beautiful, very romantic film, well acted. But after that film, he just got so famous and he started having this look on his face that just is always there, even when he's acting.
Yeah.
That says, I'm really famous and all the girls are in love with me and I'm dating a Kardashian now. Do we still have the Kardashian jingle?
No.
That's too bad. Anyway.
Yeah.
what do you like so much about the Villeneuve Dune?
Well, I pretty much said it very briefly already, but it's Lawrence of Arabia in space.
Okay.
A bit. I think I've seen a lot of Timothy Hare's work over the... I actually had it in reverse. I started up not really liking him, and then I grow into him. But and I think of all his performances, he... I think also due to the weight of the production, and I mean, he has scenes with Charlotte Rampling, and she's royalty. If you hear interviews with her, I mean, she's daunting for anybody.
Yeah.
I think that Timothée is completely not with that face. If you take Bones and All, which I really liked as well, I think in Bones and All, you see the unevenness of his acting way more. You see him being Timothée way more and having that expression that you just mentioned. I don't think he has that in Dune. I think Dune is awesome. And there are so many things, things about Dune that could really look foolish and silly. Mm. And that Villeneuve is just so keen and able enough to do. And what I said at the time, when Oppenheimer wasn't the thing yet, and I was a little bit more anti-Nolan than I am now, was that that there's a filmmaker who can make a science fiction production like that and make every single element regarding his production feel organic.
Mm.
And that's a true triumph. And I just couldn't believe it. I've seen it 3 times on the big screen. I really still cannot believe it. And I haven't... No clue as to what's going to happen for the... Well, I have little clue. I saw Jodorowsky's Dune, the documentary about the unmade 14-hour adaptation that Alejandro Jodorowsky was about to do. I mean, this is a big unfilmable book that we're talking about. That's been tried also many times. Mm. But I have no clue what's going to really happen next. I know it's like a flipped white savior kind of story, and that's also really what Villeneuve in interviews has said. That's his focus as well, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Let it come. And I'm.
So I have been reading Dune. You haven't read the book, but I haven't finished it yet either. But I would say this is actually also one that, I mean, it's considered unadaptable for good reason, because the most interesting part of Dune, I think, is the really rich... intelligent and spiritual life of all the characters. So they have a lot of layers, and Duke Leto and Paul and his mother, they are the Lady Jessica. They are all just...
Oh, Rebecca Ferguson.
They are so deep, and they are like, they're really interesting, I think.
Rebecca Ferguson is the best thing as Lady Jessica about Dune for me. She's
fantastic.
Ridiculously good.
Really,
because
really good.
What you're just saying about her character is being spiritually... I mean, you can see it on but her. Within 10 seconds, you have this breadth of a character already present there.
Yes, and you need someone who can radiate like this kind of grace and integrity or something. And I feel like, yes, she does that perfectly. Yeah. I really like... what's his name? The dad.
Oh, yeah, Oscar Isaac.
Yes, I think he's great. Not sure if he's right for this role, but I still think he's doing a really good job.
I see, you know, and the character from the book that you're already more critical.
Right. He feels and then Chalamet, I think, like he's just wrong for it. He lacks a kind of naivete, maybe, to just get it right. But that's my personal opinion. I don't think he's wrong. He might be a better choice than Kyle MacLachlan. Potato face. But I
potato face.
I hope you'll watch the old one. I'm very curious to see what you
I mean, not now, because I don't want spoilers for the second part in a way. Yeah,
that is really funny. Most people do it the other way around.
Yeah.
They won't watch the movie until the book is out.
Yeah, but I'm also... have no intention of reading Dune, I have to say.
Okay.
Because it's sci-fi. I don't think I want to read. So much flibbity bong and boggity fling.
When
it's
on a
film,
then
it's better. Okay. I've read some pages as Gonneke was reading it in the train. I was like watching along, and I was like, "That's good, well written. It reads along." And yeah, that's my only insights to that one.
Okay, fair enough. It does have silly names and all that stuff.
Yes. Script.
Cool.
No, it's Tate. Do you have one?
Oh, but I thought you were already talking about it too.
About Dune?
Yeah.
How much time? No. I have a quick one that I want. Oh, or show it now. Let's do a vraagcide. Oh, see, old fashioned. This is more of the rambling. You know what this house is called? I mean, this is the first time that Carolina is here in this house.
The House of Ramble?
No, this is House of Hip. This is where house it all started. Hip. You're in the center, the epicenter of the universe.
Oh, I feel the weight of history now.
This is the nexus where all things collide. I mean, this is where.
Is that why Fellini I'm talking so fast?
Fellini thought of 8.5.
Am I possessed?
Yes, that's what happened. So I've got an old-fashioned quiz. My question to you is, each time I've got to name some films, and I want you to tell me whether it's an adaptation, if you know the writer, if it's something else than a regular adaptation.
Do you want trivia?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And I just want to see like how these are all classics. Yeah.
Okay. Let's appropriate the bell one more time.
No. This is the thinking music. This is.
Sorry.
This is okay. Let's go. The French Connection. Wim Friedkin.
Book.
Non-fiction.
Non-fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Have you seen it?
I have seen it. I have not read it, but I know that it's a book too. Milos Forman? No? What's his name?
The director, yeah.
Yeah, that's the director. Not the writer. I don't know the name of the writer.
King Kong.
You wrote it down, so it's probably an adaptation. Or it's
No. I've just got the names that this is my quiz. I wrote everything down that I'm going to ask you. So this is no indication for if it's an adaptation or not.
Oh, okay.
King Kong? No, it's not. It's a cinematic original.
Oh, great. That's what I thought.
It's a cinematic original myth. It's There Will Be Blood.
Ooh. That's another Paul Thomas Anderson. I remember seeing it twice in a row in the theaters in 2008 when it came out. I loved it. I was blown away that opening shot with the mountains and the music and all about it. I have no idea where it comes from. I think it's also an original.
It's an original. Very good, very good, very good. But it has to feel like it's an adaptation. I was just thinking about it.
That could have been. Same time as No Country for Old Men, and that's why maybe they kind of seem like...
Yeah. But No Country for Old Men is also an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
An adaptation?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, it is.
Not really.
Oh.
And yes.
But I read it.
He wrote it as a screenplay.
I see.
And then he didn't get it sold, so he adapted himself into a novel.
Whoa.
And then the Coens adapted it from that novel.
That is a wild ride.
Weird history. Yeah.
Wow.
2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yes. Kubrick, of course.
Yes.
That was the trivia part. I'm still thinking about the book part, yes or no?
Yes.
I'm going to go with yes, a book.
No.
Okay.
If you said yes in a short story, then also history is weird. It's inspired by, based on, so not adapted from, The Sentinel by Arthur C. Clarke from the 50s.
Okay.
And then he and Arthur C. Clarke wrote the screenplay for 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
And that's also the moment when Arthur C. Clarke produced the book 2000. So that's inspired by Kubrick. It's, again, one of those...
You are coming up with really complicated timelines. Or
Blade Runner, that's my last one. A true nerdy should be like, I know.
Book. No? But it's an adaptation.
Yeah, but you don't know the writer. So do androids sleep dream when they sleep
course.
At night? Philip K. Dick, it's like a short story.
Yes. I read very little science fiction, but I did know this actually. I'm just, that was a brain freeze. That's not what that's called.
A brain freeze.
Fart. No. What's that? Well, whatever.
There you go.
Anyway, good list.
Sure. So cool. What's your favorite book adaptation?
I brought two. One that I really wanted to mention but don't want to go in depth into is Sense and Sensibility. I feel like so far I haven't really talked about romance on this podcast.
I was thinking about like Jane Austen as being, those are, I think, pretty much the archetypal book adaptations.
They are perfect to adapt, but I will say I didn't enjoy the book.
Is it Austen though?
That much? Yeah, it is.
I was just throwing something out.
And you're like, yeah. And I feel like when I read it, it's just kind of hard to relate to or something. I think there's a lot of irony, but then I just don't know enough about social relations in that era to kind of get what's real and what isn't or something. And then, of course, the adaptations are more modern because everybody watching it should be able to follow. Sense and Sensibility, the film, Sense and Sensibility. It's Ang Lee, makes really good romance films. I also love Lost Caution. Anyway, it's basically Emma Thompson just suffering for a few hours because she loves someone and she thinks she can never have him. And she is the image of being having integrity and being a good person who cares about other people, and she takes care of everyone, but nobody takes care of her because they don't know her secret that she loves this man who she can't have. And it's really hard. And it has a very passionate Kate Winslet role. She wants big love and like some...
big Kate Winslet roles are always a knife's edge. You never know how they're going to pack up. Sometimes they're Titanic and sometimes they're the reader.
Right. I thought she was annoying but convincing. And,
okay, that's good.
Yeah.
That's, I think, good.
And Alan Rickman is really nice. Hugh Grant is Hugh Grant. Yeah. Would recommend. Watch that. If I need to see a film that I know without a shadow of a doubt that will make me cry, I go for that one.
And that brings me to my film, Shadow of a Doubt. Oh, no.
What I actually wanted to talk about is something you already mentioned, which is adaptation. I rewatched it this weekend just because I wanted to have it fresh.
Okay. And
it's a Charlie Kaufman story. It's also one of those where you can't really say, like, is it an adaptation?
What is it?
He was supposed to adapt a book. What's the title?
It's on flowers, right?
So bad, yeah. It's a orchid something by a writer for the New Yorker. Orlean. Anyway, he was supposed to turn this book into a screenplay, and he couldn't do it. This is all real life. This is not the movie yet. However, The Orchid Thief. That's what it was. He decided, since he can't turn the book into a screenplay, he'll just turn his struggle to adapt the book into a screenplay. And what happens is that he kind of adapts the book. And that's a story about an orchid thief. It's I keep losing names today. I couldn't think of Meryl Streep. That's really sad in a film podcast. Anyway, it's Meryl Streep as the writer, and she's like
Mrs.
a clean
Streep.
New York intellectual lady, and she becomes intrigued by this man who steals orchids because he wants to. He loves orchids, so it's not like he has any ugly shadow intentions. He just wants to make sure that it survives, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she follows him around and she interviews him and whatever. And then there's Nicolas Cage, who plays Charlie Kaufman himself, and Charlie Kaufman's non-existing twin brother, Donald Kaufman. And Charlie Kaufman is struggling to write the script. He can't do it. He's completely neurotic. You hear his thoughts the whole time, a lot of voiceover, and every thought he has is something like, I like this woman, will she like me, I should say something now, she thinks I'm an idiot, and that's just like his whole train of thought the whole time. His brother is a very calm, social, successful man who also wants to become a screenwriter. And he keeps asking Charlie for advice, and decides that he's more of the adventurous type who will go for like the Hollywood script and put like the romance in even where it doesn't belong, and like the action scenes and whatever. And Charlie Kaufman is like, what is this? This is so dumb. I don't want to support your career because, you know, I'm the screenwriter here and you're just doing Hollywood stuff.
And it turned out to be a poisoned orchid.
Well, almost. It turns into a story about drugs and whatever. He needs his brother to make this unadaptable book into a movie. And he uses his ideas. And all at the same time, all these stories are just coming together. So he meets the writer and he meets the orchid guy. And it's a very complex, very fun meta narrative. Would recommend. Sorry, long story.
No, cool. I have pretty much no experience with Charlie Kaufman, except for his first film, which was Being John Malkovich.
Well, that's
a little bit overrated.
You think so?
I didn't like it. Okay. Yeah.
Not fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I'm hesitant about more Charlie Kaufman films. I have the feeling that I'm not into the fandom as much as other people are.
I think that's fair, but if you're interested in narratives, then you should see this, because the way that it's layered is just really
this sounds like the most fun of them all.
It is really funny.
I was laughing as you were just explaining the plot.
Yeah. So, hey. It's also about the question, can you make a film about flowers? And, well, I think Charlie Kaufman kind of concludes that you can't, and you have to have, like...
Well, yes, you can.
A romance and crime, but...
Okay. I was going to say Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, the best flower movie ever made. But no, that's not really true. It has a romance. Okay, I've got Starship Troopers.
Okay.
From Paul Verhoeven.
I love
because this is pretty much the most Dutch adaptation that you can make. Because Paul Verhoeven does this a lot. He goes to Hollywood and he's like, how can I be as Dutch as possible? How can I, like, kick into as many shins as possible without losing money? That's his great gift. So he got this book. I forgot who the book was by. But it's a famous book from the 50 Starship Troopers, and it's about it's Robert A. Heinlein, maybe in American, but it's a military science fiction novel about an invasion by the Earth of another planet. It's the other way around. And on this planet, they have started colonies, but these colonies haven't gone unnoticed, and these the civilians of these colonies were completely butchered because the inhabitants of this planet are giant bugs. It's like, and they're like very weird, and they're deliberately written as being these repulsive creatures that are just totally unlike anything. This book is pretty goddamn fascistic. It's really fascistic. So
that sounds pretty bad.
Yeah. So Paul Verhoeven, the man from Robocop and fucking Basic Instinct, he got this book in his hands. Apparently, he claimed in interviews to only have read certain chapters. After a few pages, he threw it away. And he's like,
I mean, he's always morally questionable. Showgirls.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen Showgirls yet. It's been on my list so long. But hey,
that's my favorite Verhoeven, but keep going.
Okay, good to hear at least. Kamp Verhoeven, yeah. But no, he got this book and he was like, this is just morally repugnant stuff. How am I going to do this? So he actually took a lot from the novel, but he just ever so slightly flipped the lens into a satire of it. Mm. I remember sitting, but it's Paul Verhoeven. It's Dutch, and in a way it's right in your face, the satire, but still to American minded people it can go unnoticed, which is very weird to me. But I was sitting there in het Forum in the cinema, and in that cinema hall there was somebody who almost stood up and left because she thought that the film was actually also going along with this path, which was just silly. I mean, my most favorite Paul Verhoeven trick is always that in his American films, at least, every single film of it has an advertisement, an internal advertisement that builds up the world. Yeah. Because Paul Verhoeven went to America and he was like, everything's on sale. Everywhere's advertisements. I mean, these days in the Netherlands, it's the same. But at the time, that was a big difference for him. So you constantly have these news programs. Do you want to see more? That's the line of the film, pretty much. You've got Barney Stinson from How I Met Your Mother in an SS outfit, and then capturing the head. But it is weird. It's very gory, unnecessarily gory. At the same time, it's one of the first films of Hollywood with extensive and pitch-perfect CGI use. I mean, it still pretty much holds up. And that's also Paul Verhoeven just using it's pretty great. It's very enjoyable. It's not perfect in the slightest. It's a Paul Verhoeven film. So, but, and that's what I'm going to conclude on, it is the first film from Hollywood where a black man has a whip and whips a white man. Paul Verhoeven
in a nutshell.
Did
you fact check that?
Yeah, I think so.
How reliable, but
yes,
still, regardless
yes.
of it being the first or not, that is a very good detail.
I mean, it's typical for Hoover to do something like that, right?
I love
just
it.
Like, hey, let's have a black man that punish him with a whip. So cool.
Excellent stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you're almost sounding like you have to defend your liking for Verhoeven, but there's
Starship Troopers, maybe.
There's a place for him in the film world, right? I mean, you don't want to watch it every day.
He's been expelled so many times in a way. I mean, he was expelled from Netherlands and then he came to America, and at some point he felt expelled a bit there as well. Went back to the Netherlands, but then also found out that after his most famous Dutch movies, Zwart Boek, that he wasn't going to be able to make the films he would like to make anymore. And now, then he taught himself French, and that's why he's now in France. So, yeah.
Still doing controversial stuff, but the French seem to be able to stomach
it. His most
it.
Controversial stuff. I don't know if you've seen Elle?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, that's for another time. Yeah. That's
something with a cat that really struck me.
Oh, man. It's
and I will not soon forget.
Do you like it, though?
Yes.
Good.
I'm not sure if I'll get cancelled for this, but
No.
I
love
it.
It's a great
I already
film.
Said I like Lolita, so I guess I'm screwed anyway. Anyway.
Yes.
I think there's this one movie you really, really wanted to talk about.
Yes. Yes.
Let's have it. Killers of the Flower Moon.
Okay, there are a lot of films coming out. Next time we'll do Anatomy of Fall. I've seen Past Lives.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, then we'll keep it good.
It's been busy.
But not as good as I was hoping it to be. But yeah, Killers of the Flower Moon is Martin Scorsese's umpteenth film.
Who is this Martin?
Scorsese. Pardon me. It's Scorsese. It's his umpteenth film, his seventh collaboration with DiCaprio, and his 10th collaboration with De Niro. De Niro came with this story to Scorsese a while back, and they started working on it, and it's based on a non-fiction novel called Killers of the Flower Moon, which basically chronicles the Osage murders in Oklahoma during the 20s, which led to the foundation of the Bureau of Investigation, as it was first called, and then the Federal, so the FBI.
Used to be the BI.
The BOI.
Oh, BOI.
Yeah, sorry. I hate to break it. I just looked it up and I saw like an abbreviation. It was like, it was BOI. That's yeah.
Out of curiosity, what is a flower moon? Do you know?
It's a scene. The flower moon has to do with a field of certain flowers that's there. It's something to do with Osage mythology or legend.
Because I just saw adaptation.
Go watch the film. Like, I don't want to
flowers.
Do it.
Flowers.
Yeah, no, a lot of flowers again. So it is Scorsese with Rodrigo Prieto, with whom he worked on his last two films as well, Silence and The Irishman. The Irishman in particular is one of the better shot films, I think.
I loved Silence too, another controversial take.
Haven't seen it yet.
It's very funny. Adam Driver and Andrew Garfield are playing, 16th century Portuguese missionaries in Japan, and they have accents and everything. It's very funny.
Okay.
But that's not really why it's good. Cool. It's also just a good movie about religion. Anyway.
Yeah.
Or faith.
And Robbie Robertson from the band, the previous backing band from Bob Dylan, gives his last film score here, which is somewhere in the midst of a bluesy rendition of what Johnny Greenwood did on There Will Be Blood. It's very percussive and sometimes very, very muted in a way. It's sometimes a little bit like, but in such
like
a profound
like
way, with a few 20s pop tunes thrown in there. But it's very, and it has these beautiful anamorphic lenses which give this there's an old-fashioned feeling, but at the same time, where I was expecting this first ever Western by Martin Scorsese to be somewhat still, maybe a little bit slower in tempo, that's not the case. Even though it's 3.5 hours long, this is, I think, worth its 3.5 hours. This is an anti-white savior story about the pretty much the birth of the American century. It's about these Osage nations, which had to be removed from, in the eyes of the American military,
obviously,
had to be removed to a territory where they would be. So they went to Oklahoma, which was at the time considered to be the, just like, there's nothing there. Mm-hmm. Except there was oil. And
people.
The Osage nation became the richest people on Earth per capita. On Earth.
Wow.
Yes. This is a story about change happening too fast. It's a story about that money is not power. It's when white people have money that's power. It's a white infiltration story, which is a 3.5 hour slow burn horror, actually, that creeps on you and has these beautiful poetic edges all along. It's a lot of it is in Osage. Robert De Niro pretty much wanted to do everything in Osage, which it's a terrific language to talk to. Some of the segments aren't even subtitled. Scorsese just really wants you to listen and to just see the facial and expressions, and it works.
I am sensing some enthusiasm. You'll
Lily
like this
Gladstone
film.
as the she plays Molly, and she Leonardo DiCaprio is pretty much tasked by his uncle King Hill. Mm-hmm. Well, King already says pretty much his stature around the necks of the woods, and he's tasked to pretty much persuade her and become her wife, so he can marry into the money.
I see.
And that's how this story starts off.
I'm just saying, you are positively glowing.
Yes,
right.
I'm getting to my climax. Sorry, okay. This is my real rant. This one I planned already.
Fair enough. Go for it.
This is Scorsese in Fordian fashion, wanting to deal with, I talked about this last time, John Ford being always captivated with history and American history, but it's always tainted. Westerns aren't history. This is really history, and this is Martin Scorsese saying, look at what's happening 100 years back. Learn from it, in a way. And he actually literally says it at one point.
Is it still Western, though?
It's a Western with a lot of cars. And it's a revisionist Western, and what it also is, it merges Western with Scorsese's most well-known genre, the gangster. Mm. It's about organized crime, but in at the same time, it's completely unfamiliar.
Much like No Country for Old Men, really.
No, it's very different from No Country for Old Men.
I believe that. I just mean as genre mixing goes.
Yeah. The gangster thing comes up mainly also because it's Scorsese and because it's De Niro.
Of course.
But it's not Italian, and it's also there is an air of vileness about all their plans. Just this blatant what is it? The Hannah Arendt thing. It's a banal evil that really forces everything. This is his second film in a row that really deals with a protagonist who is in line of duty. Duty. But just somebody who has to fulfill a duty. It's like a soldier. But here, this time around, it's not a soldier in work of a gang. This is somebody tasked to marry into an Osage nation for them. It's so much more... Enfin, I can say about this whatever I want. I don't want to spoil a lot, but there is so much to spoil because it's such an incredibly wide and breathtaking film. This is one
really
of the films
sad.
Of the year. It's really sad. This is the first time, I think, during a Martin Scorsese film that I couldn't keep my eyes dry.
Are you embarrassed to admit?
No, not really. But I mean, it didn't happen during The Age of Innocence, which has a more romantic gut punch and is also incredible. This is one of his best movies to date.
Wow.
I think it's one of the films of the year. I think it's pretty much perfect.
I can't wait to see it and see if I hate it. And then, you know,
I don't think you'll like it as
much.
Spit
on it next time.
You probably think it's a bit too long. But
I really like a long film as long as it's really good.
Well, and this one had a break. And this is maybe a little bit of a caveat, but I don't know what happened to movie going. Why did we, with all the emergence of phones came, our attention spans became shorter, and what did cinemas do? No breaks.
I think maybe it was just, you know, a counter thing. Like, they couldn't make their peace with it. I need a break. I always have to pee. I mean, you order a drink or something. Or even if you don't, 3.5 hours, you really can't tell if your bladder is going to last that long.
You know that William Friedkin quote, why his movies are always 2 hours?
No.
I mean, 3 hours a movie can be fine, but after 2 hours, your ass just gives up. So, so his movies are 2 hours.
I guess he didn't used to go to festivals or anything.
No, probably not, though.
Anyway.
Killers of the Flower Moon. It's, great.
For the people out there, Data is glowing. He's radiating a big smile. So go
see
this one.
I want to see it again.
When are you going to go?
I don't know. I first have to get through this exam period.
Oh, yes. Good point.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, yeah.
You could talk about Scorsese forever, right? Scorsese. I mean, sorry. Scorsese. Martin Scorsese.
But it's just such a good film. And now saying this all just makes it come back a bit, and it's a good feeling. It's a good feeling. It's a, yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see it.
And beautiful.
Mm.
Yes.
Is it
date of data film? It's a very much a data film. Very much so. It's absolutely not a date film.
Very unromantic.
No. Well, now that you bring it up.
Spoilers.
No, not really. But DiCaprio and Lily Gladstone is...
Is she 22 or...?
No. She's... I mean...
Sorry, it was a joke about Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course. I refer to this as the syndrome of DiCaprio.
Mm.
Something of which I am not, I repeat, not exhibited. But no, they have this incredibly unspoken chemistry. And also, I mean, DiCaprio has to lie constantly to his wife in this film. I mean, there's so much unspoken, like, what's her name in The Irishman? The actress that didn't say a word all the while.
I haven't seen
Anna Paquin.
Oh, right.
Anna Paquin didn't, and she was the best thing about the film because she didn't say actress. Anything. Lily Gladstone says more, but she...
And the second to youngest Oscar winner.
Lily Gladstone doesn't say anything, and still there is so much... she pretty much knows that something is completely off. And still there's... And everything about that relationship is believable. That's the romance in there. But it's not a date film, no.
Okay, fair enough.
It doesn't end too well in a way. Like, emotionally speaking, it just gives you away. You walk away melancholic.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have another
this rant was justified.
No, but it was justified. I mean, you really wanted to talk about this film, and yes. You did. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
I do have another question for you.
Okay.
Is there any book that you read that you feel like should be a film?
I know I made up this question, but I haven't thought.
I made up this question too. I mean, it's just there for the picking.
La Superba, Ilya Leonard Pfeiffer.
I haven't read it.
It's a Dutch book, which is in a style that's very cinematic with some poetry in there. And it's pretty much on the verge of La Dolce Vita on the one hand and Naked Lunch on the other.
Wow.
Very weird merger. But that's what happens if you were to say, let's put La Dolce Vita in a more fragmented style in Genova. That's what you get then.
Mm.
That would be very ambitious to adapt. And it's one of my favorite. It's my favorite Dutch book, actually.
We should ask Cronenberg.
No.
I'm joking.
No. You need somebody with more Fellini in them.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I'm not a Fellini person.
I am.
It's
we'll do a Fellini episode.
No.
Well.
Have only one thing to say about Fellini.
That's that you find him sexist?
No, that I find La Strada so insufferable. I don't want to look at a sad clown for 2 hours.
Let's cut it out now. You said La Strada was insufferable. That's
yes, so annoying.
10 movie for me.
The most annoying film ever made.
Oh, no, it's
if that
beautiful.
Woman dies in the first 2 seconds, I'd be really
happy.
Oh, and that
ending with him on the beach, I was crying. Oh, Fellini.
Just go away.
Man of my heart.
Well, man, you won't accept this clown. Lady.
Oh no, it's amazing. Oh, it's such
lady.
A beautiful fairy tale. Oh, you're just smashing it to bits.
Finally, like, I get like my revenge for in the mouth of
Pinocchio and then grabbing him by its nose and then just like tearing him apart and like, there's your Pinocchio, he's just a wooden doll. I don't buy it.
I didn't say it to get this response, but I'm still really happy that I got it.
That was for Hip, I guess.
Yeah, let's wrap it up.
Get in contact with us via the email for Hip and the filmpodcast@gmail.com. It's still the Dutch one because it's hard to change. But just get in touch via Instagram. It's easier for Hip and Film Podcast. Or via the Q&A function, I think, on Spotify. There is also React.
Really?
I haven't checked it out. We can also ask our audience things.
Interesting.
Anyway, see you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And don't forget to, once in a while, just bring enough food and drinks if you're going somewhere. I mean, take care of yourself.
Is that a...
No.
No.
Fair. Hip.
Top tip.
No, that's go watch La Strada and then Killers of the Flower Moon. Hoppa!
I will do no such thing.
Ah, joh, echt? Je zit hier naast, joh. Oh.
Nee, jij zit ernaast.
Je hebt ook alleen. Oh.
Je praat Nederlands.